In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky.
You okay, man?
Mellow.
I thought I'd mellow it out a little bit.
Smooth sounds of Aaron Lammer.
Yeah, I'm feeling smooth.
Is it because of the conversation you had for this week's episode?
It was a great conversation. I don't know how smooth. I don't know if it was smooth per se.
Who was it with?
I was with John Seabrook, who is a longtime New Yorker writer, but recently had a book out called "The Song Machine: Inside the Hit Factory." I think it came out a week or two ago. It's awesome. It's a great book. It's sort of about how a small group of Swedish people took over the American pop charts, but it's also in a larger sense about how the entire production style of music changed to this team kind of, lots of people have a hand in it. There's all sorts of really interesting stuff. He's had a few pieces in The New Yorker.
Yeah, he's kind of like been like working on this book The New Yorker for a while.
Yeah, we had a really interesting conversation about how he sort of built these pieces he did for The New Yorker, which included a piece on K-pop. There's a piece adapted from the book about Max Martin, who's kind of the central figure in the songwriting stuff, and how he built that into a larger narrative. And then we also talked about how he does a lot of Talk of the Town pieces and how his features are in many ways kind of a mashup of like five Talk of the Town pieces sometimes. So it was interesting.
Got a system going.
Yeah, he's got a whole nested Matryoshka doll.
About time for us to go deep on the New Yorker editorial process.
Hey.
How do you game the New Yorker?
Do we have any sponsors this week?
Speaking of games, we do. EA Sports, FIFA 16. They are so generous that they're giving us more games to give away. We got like hundreds and hundreds of emails a couple weeks ago when we did it. So the first 10 people who hear this, email podcast@longform.org, and you will get a free copy of the game. Let us know whether you want Xbox or PS4, and seriously, like, email right now because they were gone in seconds last time.
Yeah, if you're hearing this and this is days late, this is days after this episode came out, there are no games left.
Even if it's like Wednesday evening, you probably are not getting a game.
Max will still personally respond to you if you email, but you won't get a game.
My guilt is so so deep. I write back to all those emails.
I am so sorry. We are out of games.
Speaking of emails, Aaron.
Well, if I was trying to send out emails the way EA sends out games, I'd need to start an email newsletter, and I'd do so with MailChimp. Over 8 million businesses rely on it. Make yours the next one. Longform uses it. Atavist uses it. It's great. It's the only name in the game, MailChimp. Thank you, MailChimp.
And now here's Aaron with John Seabrook.
Welcome, John Seabrook. Thanks for coming in. I've seen you have a new book out. Is the book out?
The book is out.
Tell us the name of the book before
it
we get
is
going.
The Song Machine Inside the Hit Factory, published by Norton.
Published by W.W. Norton, by my high school classmate, is your editor,
Tom
Mayer.
You guys have similar beards.
Yeah, we actually, there was a period of time where we would get mistaken for each other.
Yeah.
People would come up to me and say, I really loved you in that reggae band.
Yeah.
And I said, I've never, ever been in a reggae band.
I didn't know Tom was actually in a reggae band.
Yeah, I'm kind of blowing up Tom's spot there.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get
actually, reggae is the better end of it. It started as a ska band. So this book's everywhere right now. There's been people writing about it. I guess my first question is, so this book tackles this evolution of music that's happening now as both as these small group of Swedish people are coming to dominate pop songwriting, but simultaneously the shift towards this sort of factory, lots of hands in the kitchen kind of process. Why is this topic so fascinating to people?
I think partly is that no one's ever written a book about it.
Yeah.
It's this huge change that's taken place over the last 25 years, going from melody plus lyrics method of writing songs to what I call in the book a track plus hook, in which the producer comes first and then the melody comes and then the lyrics come, rather than basically the other way around. And also the way the songs are actually recorded are now all done on computers with programming and not with session musicians, except in very rare exceptions. So that's a very large change in our culture. And yet it hasn't been covered by a book before. And so I think people have not seen it in terms of that 25-year arc. They've seen kind of pieces of it.
Yeah.
You know, we know that, you know, technology has become more a part of making music. And we know that the producers are more powerful than they used to be. And we know that something about Sweden is involved. But it hasn't ever really been kind of put together, which is actually interesting. Why not? You know, because it is sort of glaringly obvious as a book topic. And I guess it's partly that, you know, maybe serious people aren't supposed to write books about pop music.
Right.
That's one of them. And also that the industry hasn't really been very eager for people to know about this thing. And so it's, you know, it's hard to get inside of it.
I want to start there with one of the things you said, which is people aren't supposed to take pop music too seriously. And I think in reading the book, the first sort of leap the reader needs to make, and I think you make as a writer, is taking the music that you're covering seriously, or not simply kind of having to constantly stop and go like, and this is a Backstreet Boys song we're talking about. What was that like for you as a writer to sort of step into that mindset?
I knew when I took on the book that I was going to have to write from a position inside the music and not outside the music. I felt like at a certain point in writing this book, I was kind of writing a musical. You know, there would be like a song and then there would be some action and then there would be another song. And the songs became sort of the poles around which various points of the narrative revolved. And I just embraced the songs, I guess.
Yeah.
I think I'm able to communicate with my kind of wry voice that I kind of get it, that I'm listening to a Backstreet Boys song here.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, necessarily the thing I want to do most, you know, in my life. But at the same time, I'm sort of willing to take it on its own terms. And the success of the songs was also an important sort of a factor in taking them seriously, because whether or not they were good, they were very successful, and understanding why was a valid, you know, sort of pursuit, even if ultimately the Backstreet Boys are not your favorite band.
Well, what's it like when you're trying to research a topic like this, and you're coming from an outsider's perspective, and you sort of describe needing to become an insider in a way, like, what are the entry points to a world like this? How do you say, hey, I want to know everything about how you make music, the man who's made the most number one singles in the last 20 years? Are people receptive to a project like this?
No, definitely not. The New Yorker was a powerful juju in this whole process. The New Yorker is very highly respected by people in the music business, even though they may not all read it. Whatever reservations they had about, you know, remaining anonymous were overbalanced by their desire to be in The New Yorker. And actually, Aaron, something that somebody said after, when I did the first article, which was about Stargate, I remember afterwards their manager, Tim Blacksmith, said, "Now I can explain to my mother what I do." He could give her the article, and his mother would understand what he did. And before that, his mother didn't understand what he did. And that was a very powerful motivator, you know.
Which dovetails in some ways with this book feeling like both like a story about music and a story about technology. And
right.
Technology is generally the industry where people's mothers least understand
right.
what they're doing for a living.
Right.
So beyond the sort of motivation for doing it, there's a lot of things in this book that are almost like trade secrets about
yeah.
how these songs are constructed. Was there any tension between like, hey, this is how I do this, but don't put this in the book? Like, is there an off-the-record element to the reporting of it?
There wasn't a lot of off-the-record stuff. Stargate, they were very open. They trusted me. Dr. Luke was another order of paranoia, you know, and now I think he's like five more orders of paranoia still. But he was definitely he was trying to act kind of cool, but it wasn't about how they work. It was more just about like the records that they're working on, and you know, are they going to get Drake on this project or not? You know, it's that kind of stuff. It wasn't really about, you know, how they make the songs. I mean, Luke talked to me, actually, a fair amount about The Matrix, who had been this hit-making group in the early 2000s who had written songs for Avril Lavigne, like Complicated and Skater Boy. They basically gave an interview in which they said, "We wrote these songs." You know, it's absurd to think that she wrote them. We wrote them. And that was basically the last time they ever got a gig. So Luke was very aware of not taking any credit for, you know, the Katy Perry songs or the Kesha songs, even if he felt that he, you know, was the main author of those songs. And so any suggestion that he did have something to do with them would have been considered off the record.
What is your presence like when you're sitting in a recording studio with Dr. Luke? Like, are you quietly taking notes? Are you asking questions?
Yeah, I try to sort of be a fly on the wall. That's my general kind of position, is to sort of let things happen.
Yeah.
And if I can get two people in the studio sort of interacting with each other, then it's better. Because you can kind of set up a dialogue between the two of them. And I kind of like dialogue, and I rely on it fairly often. So, and then, you know, if things are kind of quiet, yeah, I'll ask a question. I tend to sort of try to, if I'm going to ask a bunch of questions, then I'll do it in like a sort of interview format that's disassociated from the hangout format. So like in Luke's case, we sat downstairs, you know, in the sort of living room area, and I asked him a bunch of questions, and he answered them. And, you know, then we went upstairs, and he started doing his thing in the studio, and I more hung out, and then would ask about stuff that I didn't understand. You let the scene develop so it feels like it's just unfolding in front of you, and I'm not necessarily there or not there. It's just, I ended up taking myself out a lot, actually, when I was revising it. You know, he told me, I would just take out and say, you know, he said or he says. And I kind of tried to erase myself in the end as much as possible. I always try to let the material sort of speak to me. You know, like I have certain preconceptions going in about what would work as a piece or, you know, what I need. But as much as possible, I try to let things happen and then, you know, I record it all on my phone. I don't take a lot of notes. I have a kind of a very casual style, I think. And I try to put people at ease. And you know, I don't really try to get people, really. I'm not looking, you know, for some sort of gotcha. You know, I feel like I'm kind of on their side.
It's interesting because you said there was this incident with the Matrix, who were the Stargate of 2002,
right.
Where they said, and that was a little bit closer on the heels of like the when was Milli Vanilli? That was the mid 90s.
That was early 90s, late 80s.
Late 80s, yeah.
Late 80s.
So there was this kind of like building history of, hey, it's kind of a problem if you're publicly saying you wrote someone else's music,
yes.
And that there's, but. You know, I think probably the number one hit right now is a Weeknd song,
right.
That Max Martin quite openly produced. And you can go on, you know, there's many websites you can go and see who produced any song. So it seems like there's a weird, like, what exactly is the secret that's being kept in the bag? What would they be freaked out about people finding out when this information is all over the internet?
I don't know if there is any one big. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like I don't know. I mean, everybody knows that these artists don't write their own songs. I mean, if they think about it for 5 seconds, they know that. And you know, it's something that's happened for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't happen during the singer-songwriter era, but apart from that, it was basically the normal position. So I don't think they have anything to fear about people knowing that. I think the difference between now and like say the Brill Building era is that the artists are much more powerful in that their image is extremely important. They're not just sort of puppets in the hands of the producers. Like Katy Perry has significant power in her relationship with Dr. Luke and Max Martin, that, you know, everyone's very worried about pissing one of these artists off, because no matter how good you are and no matter how much of the song you actually write, if the artist doesn't do the song, you're done, you know? I mean, so I feel like that was kind of the major source of anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety in the music business. There just is, you know. I think there's fear. There's a lot of people fearing for their jobs, you know, and now with the, you know, since Napster, you know, not knowing where the revenues were going to come from, just ratcheted up the fear level. And then you can kind of obsess about the artist getting pissed off at you if you're one of the producers, and that just kind of adds on to it.
Well, and I think that you pretty artfully in the book depict, it's not purely a situation of one person is a puppet and these people are writing for the puppet, that there is a relationship and sort of an intricate dance between
right.
artists and producers. And even someone like Katy Perry, who maybe doesn't have soul credit on any of her songs.
Right.
You see there are these songwriting sessions, and there are this whole world that creates the music. I'm curious as to how you regarded the protagonist of this book as characters. We learn lots and lots about how they do what they do, but I can't think of a single time in the book anyone talks about why they do it.
Right,
so
right.
How do you go about writing people who won't sort of tell you what they care about and what they want and what the desires of their soul are?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like I approached their talent with a sort of awe that they have this kind of magic inside them that allows them to create a hit song, and that was a special sort of treasure that maybe I would never actually uncover. But that it gave what was that whatever it was inside them that it allowed them to do that a glow, sort of an attractive glow, so that even if, you know, the only reason they did it was to make a hit and to make money, if you really broke it down, there was still this rare quality that allowed them to do it. And, you know, maybe that was part of their background, maybe it was part of their process. Maybe it was part of the way they use technology, but that was, I feel like, the thing that ultimately drew me to these people and made me... I loved being in the studio with these people. I loved watching it happen. I'm in a band, you know, I play music. Not this kind of music, but, you know, old rock songs. And, you know, I, on one level, just sort of really was into their musical chops, you know, like the fact that they did the chord progression this way, And if you break down Max Martin's songs in particular, you know, the chord progressions are often very unusual. They don't really fit, you know, either, you know, sort of blues progressions or Europop progressions. And so I got into it on that level.
Yeah.
A lot, the music level.
You describe this world of producers and songwriters as both a paranoid world and a world that has a lot of fear in it. And yeah. It clearly also has a certain kind of a joy in it. But the relationships between the major players in this book, almost every character in this book was either the protege of someone else,
right.
Or how do you navigate the relationships between the people? I mean, when you're talking to Dr. Luke, is he wondering, like, hey, is Max Martin mad at me? Like, are you also thinking about how they relate to each other and the communications that are happening internally within that group? Because it's a very small group of people.
It's totally a small group of people. And it is such a sort of guild of, you know, sort of masters and apprentices. And it seems like all the learning is done literally at the side of the master. You know, I mean, you have to be proficient enough to get to the side of the master.
Yeah.
But once you get there, you know, it's very much of a sort of a master-apprentice relationship. And because the Swedes have A, been so successful, and B, have been particularly sort of mentor-apprentice oriented, you know, and it's almost like a biblical thing. You have Dennis Pop, you had like the 10 Sharon, you know, producer songwriters, and then they've gone on to having, you could draw it all up in a big family tree, and you'd basically have like 50% of the hits of the last, you know, 10 years on that. With Max Martin, you know, nobody talks about him. It's like, I think I liken him to Obi-Wan. I always felt like there was this kind of like, he's half real and half kind of ethereal. And when you meet him, you know, he doesn't seem like that at all. He's a normal, unprepossessing guy. He looks a little nervous when you're talking to him. He's not very tall. And he's working all the time and doesn't, you know, do anything to sort of exalt or call attention to himself. So, And everybody else doesn't want to say anything about him either, because everybody is extremely aware of his privacy and his need to remain, you know, anonymous. And so I really didn't even try to understand like what they really thought about Max. I mean, I think they really wanted to work with Max, and so whatever would make them work with Max is what they thought about Max, because it just sort of seems like if you can work with Max, then everything can change in your life.
What you're describing is sort of a reporting nightmare, which is someone who is both reticent and who other people are afraid to talk about.
That's
with
right.
You. What, like, where did you push through those
Well,
limits?
You know what, in the end, Aaron, I sort of felt like this, and I sort of put this into my New Yorker adaptation last week, that ultimately this guy is this kind of shadow, this kind of ghost, or this sort of, as you know, to be a little bit glib about it, blank space in our pop music culture. I got a lot of stuff about him from other people, so it's like he's kind of there in outline and in some pretty good detail in terms of, you know, his experiences as a kid, what the parents' record collection, music school in Sweden, the whole early glam rock period when he was in this band called It's Alive. It's sort of an amazing start for this guy. And there are videos of their performances, for this few short years of his life, he was a performer. And then, you know, all that shut down. He's kind of dull in a lot of ways, but, you know, he's not dull in what he's accomplished.
The blank space is sort of the right way to describe it. I would say there's maybe 10 personal details about him in the whole book. And, and that's including very small details.
Right.
Even.
You don't know anything about his marriage, his children. The one thing that I actually would have liked something about is the time when the industry kind of turned its back on him which is after 2000, the Backstreet Boy thing kind of burst all of a sudden. You know, Eminem was suddenly all the rage, and you know, I Want It That Way sounded kind of lame to a lot of people, and he was, you know, as one of his colleagues says in the book, he was like the sixth Backstreet Boy,
right?
And so, you know, no one really wanted to work with him, and that would be actually interesting to know, like, how that affected him, how that changed him, you know, how that made him. Cause I assume he resolved never to let himself be in that situation again by constantly switching up his collaborators as soon as he felt the, you know, the tide begin to turn. You know, so since 2004, he hasn't had another one. He came back with Since You've Been Gone, which is the classic Dr. Luke kind of indie rock pop song. And, you know, then he had that great run of kind of indie rock sounding hits. They weren't really indie rock, but they had a kind of an indie vibe with Dr. Luke. But now, you know, he's moved beyond that, really. More electro. I don't know what you would
call. Almost like Quincy Jonas vibe to some of the stuff, like the Weekend songs, I think, have a sort of Thriller kind of vibe to them.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here for a quick word from our sponsor, Masterclass. For the first time, Masterclass is making it possible for anyone to learn from the best in the world. Have you ever wanted to learn acting from Dustin Hoffman? How about tennis from Serena Williams? Or me, myself, I took a course writing with James Patterson. Outlining with James Patterson, how to market your book with James Patterson. A lot of pretty interesting stuff for people from a variety of backgrounds. The way it works is you pay $90, you get 3 to 5 hours of video lessons from the instructor, plus workbooks, interactive exercises, and Q&A with the instructors. This is lifetime access, so you can go back to it whenever you want. The production value is outstanding. They've got Academy Award-winning directors working on each one. They've got great engineers, so you can access this from your phone, wherever. It's a beautiful, high-quality experience, and it's something I've never had access to before, someone at that level teaching me. So I want you to go to masterclass.com/longform. Again, that's masterclass.com/longform. $90 a class. You'll be learning something new and supporting the show. Thank you, Masterclass. Here I am back with John Seabrook.
As a writer, you said that you started at 29 at the New Yorker. What, like, or that was when you got your first piece published?
Right.
What's your Max Martin story? What is your origin? Where did you get your start?
You know, all of that New Yorker stuff and the idea of the New Yorker, and particularly of John McPhee, came from John McPhee and from Princeton, which is where I went to college and studied with him. When I arrived there, I had no notion of being a writer, and I certainly wasn't thinking about the New Yorker. And my early writing experiences were more doing fiction at college. But, you know, junior year, I took that course he teaches. I've since taught it myself, called The Literature of Fact. And, you know, the notion that you can use, you know, sort of novelistic techniques in a nonfiction context, you know, of course, that's the bedrock of sort of new journalism. But, you know, I guess I had to sort of figure it out for myself. And John was a very inspiring teacher, and also sort of became a friend. And so by the time I was out of college, I really had, you know, the New Yorker kind of on the brain. And then it was just a question of how do you actually get there?
I want to pause you for one sec there, because If I were to poll people who've been on this show, I would say maybe 10% of them came through that John McPhee class. I mean, it's
really
an incredible, actually, in some ways, much like Chiron in Sweden. It's an incredible factory for several generations of
David
journalists.
David Remnick did too.
What was the class? Like, I hear about it so many times in the show, and I always want to ask what the course itself was like. And I've heard very different things from different people about their memory of what McPhee's class was.
You know, the thing that always stayed with me, even though eventually I had to kind of throw it out, was his discussions of structure. Structure is, I think, the single most important quality to determining whether you're going to make it as a long form writer. You know, you have to have some kind of innate sense of structure. And you have to, even if it's not so clear that you could actually make an outline of it before you start writing, and I never actually do make outlines, but part of the writing is figuring out what that structure is that you have a glimpse of. John's famous, you may have heard this from one of your other guests, but John's famous line was that like the lead of a story should be like a flashlight quickly shined around inside an urn very quickly so that you get a sense of the dimensions of the urn, but you're not really all that sure what it is yet. And I always felt like when I was done with the reporting of a story that I had that kind of sense that, okay, there is some structure here. And you know, it's like the statue inside the block of marble that's already, like the Michelangelo idea that's already sort of done. It's just a question of freeing the statue from the marble. I always sort of felt that way. And I think, you know, John would do these crazy diagrams of his structure. He would show how the piece, I remember him doing it for the Roadkill piece, Georgia, Travels in Georgia, I guess it was called. And it starts out with this guy who was traveling around with, who was stopping to collect roadkill. And he had this whole elaborate sort of diagram about, you know, how things plugged into this and foreshadowed this and then circled back to this. And even though, like, in the end, when I actually started writing for The New Yorker and started to try to do that stuff, and then I realized that if I ever tried that, first of all, it would be crappy, and second of all, I would lose my mind. And so I basically just had to throw it all out. But it was, I guess it gave it a kind of an engineering kind of a vibe, which I liked. It wasn't just, you know, poetry or, you know, sitting around and being creative. There was a sort of engineering aspect to it. And John was, you know, he was always, even though, you know, he's a writer and a esteemed writer and a wonderful writer, but he never really seemed like a writer, you know? Like, he was always just like a curious dude that, yeah, more like the people he wrote about, like a geologist or an engineer. And I guess I kind of responded to that too. You know, I just sort of felt, oh yeah, this is not some, you don't have to be like Balzac sitting in an attic drinking, you know, 100 cups of coffee in the day. You can sort of live your life like, you know, you can have a wife and kids and sort of have an institutional association. That was the other thing about The New Yorker, I guess, that appealed to me, was that it was an institution and it had, you know, a kind of, American kind of traditional sort of, it wasn't, before they called them brands, you know, sort of, you know, imprimatur or something. And so that was appealing too, but still, there was probably 8 years in between, you know, the time I took that course and the time I actually got an assignment to work for The New Yorker.
I was going to say, what was your sort of idea of how one became a New Yorker writer at that point?
I really didn't know. And, one of my friends he didn't stay in college, but it was J.D. Salinger's son, Matt Salinger, and I'd gotten to know Jerry, through Matt, and we'd visit him in his house in Cornish and stuff, and he was the person that I knew who
I think
was
it's for sale now, actually.
Yeah, I actually saw the real estate ad in New Hampshire. It's pretty cheap, actually.
I think a lot of people are like, "Wow, you can get J.D.
It's like
$540,000,
right?" I don't know if you get the bunker,
you get a studio, and
So I actually asked him, I remember he was kind of cross with me. I said, how do you write for The New Yorker? He said, you write. You know, he was very sort of like impatient. Of course, you write. And I was like, okay, but like maybe I could try to, do they have, you know, like jobs or, you know, can you do something? You can start somewhere. And so he said, I have no idea, but I'll see what I can do. And he actually called up. At that point, he hadn't written for The New Yorker for, you know, however many. That was probably like 1984. And I think his last piece was published in 1964. So he didn't have a whole lot of context. But he did have E.J. Kahn, who was, you know, one of the older writers, famous for his five-part series on grain, which has now become the symbol of everything that the old New Yorker sort of excessively did. And so I actually went to see E.J. Kahn in his office in the old building, maybe like three buildings back. And he was totally unhelpful. And
so Salinger was just like, one of my son's friend wants to write for the New Yorker.
Yeah.
Can he come by your office?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a high pressure situation.
I mean, it's just like, you know, I guess what I'm sometimes called on to do now by my, you know, friends who have a son that, you know, wants to, and I'm actually, you know, nicer about it than E.J. Kahn was. So, you know, I did that, but that didn't lead anywhere. And clearly the way to The New Yorker was to go and work somewhere else and sort of prove your, you know, learn. I never really studied. I did the McPhee course, but I never really sort of did like a journalism, like school type thing where you learn about, you know, all the sort of more sort of nuts and bolts stuff of journalism. And so I wasn't quite sure how to break in, but I started writing book reviews, actually. I got some freelance book reviews in The Voice, The Christian Science Monitor, The Nation published one. And then a guy who worked at this magazine that was starting up in the mid-'80s, early mid-'80s, called Manhattan Inc. It was a business magazine. Said to
sounds
me,
like the business magazine in like a in a movie.
Yeah, Manhattan. Exactly. It was Manhattan sort of Wall Street era, yep. 1986, before the whole thing kind of fell apart and the crash came. And you know, he asked me to write some arts pieces for the back of the magazine. And then when I wrote one or two, and he said, these are good. Why don't you try a profile for the magazine? And so I did that. And he said, well, this is actually good. How would you like to, have a sort of a contract where you write? So I sort of did that and became this kind of business profile writer. And that didn't lead to The New Yorker, but that did lead to Vanity Fair. And Tina Brown brought me to Vanity Fair. And Tina Brown, who would, you know, I thought would be the last person that ever comes to The New Yorker, came to The New Yorker. But that actually ended up being kind of a good thing for me because she knew me and she knew that I was interested in stuff that she was also interested in. And she could kind of trust me as a more of an ally of hers. There was a lot of snobbery.
Sounds like a lot of paranoia and fear.
There was a lot of paranoia and fear. And there was a lot of snobbery, too, directed Tina's way.
Yeah.
You know?
I know that there is a certain amount of paranoia and fear at all magazines, and New Yorker being one of near the top, I assume that that's amplified. At what point did you? You've been there. What is this now going on?
I became a staff writer in '93, so okay. It's 23 years.
23 years going on 25 years. 25, what point did you stop? Did the paranoia and fear ever subside, or does it still inside
I'm
you?
I'm not paranoid. I am fearful of. Actually, I used to be more. I think fearful. I think for any writer, you know, the assumption is that when you're starting out at the New Yorker, you're just not going to be as good as, you know, the people who came before you, who were your role models, just because they were great and you're just you. And, you know, you're really surprised when some of those people themselves actually sort of compliment you on your work, and you begin to think that maybe you have something that might be special. But, you know, the fear is mainly that you don't, and that it's going to be discovered with the next piece. And it took me a while, you know, years probably, to get over that. Also, you sort of begin to think that maybe the fear is a good thing, because it's sort of a motivating factor and it gets you to the deadline and gets the piece done. And, you know, there's probably something to be said for that. But I guess I have become a little bit more confident in my ability that I am going to get it. You know, I am going to figure it out. And it doesn't necessarily have to come out right the first time, you know, and that I have always figured it out before to one degree or another, you know, and also I guess the feeling is that I have is that we have a lot of, you know, really great younger writers who are, you know, busting their asses to write as much as they can, and I don't feel as, you know, sort of urgently compelled to do it as much. This is a very interesting thing. It's kind of like there's a huge literary Home Alone moment when you write pieces that are published in the New Yorker, and, you know, the copy editors, the OKers, your editor, they take out your jokes, they cut your prose, they make you put things in like a New Yorker way. You're like, you know, tearing your hair out. Then you get a book contract and you turn those published pieces back into Microsoft Word documents, and suddenly, like I say, you're home alone. Your editor's not there. The copy editor's not there. Nobody is there. You can restore the piece to your, you know, original sort of, you know, voice with all of your mannerisms and quirks that the New Yorker, you know, sort of shaved off in order to make it into a New Yorker piece. And that is a very existential moment, you know, because you have to really ask yourself, what is my voice? What is the New Yorker's voice? And, you know, what is the overlap between both?
Yeah.
And that, which is the sort of the sweet spot that you kind of want to be in. And it's basically taken me 4 books to figure that out. And this is really the first book that I felt like, and the irony, of course, is that once you are home alone and you do have the opportunity to put the jokes back in, you don't in almost every case, because maybe that was the right, or even if you don't, it wasn't the right way to go. At this point, my voice and the New Yorker's voice have sort of, you know, merged so much.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm surprised to hear that you still have two voices, right, in your head after 23 years.
Yeah, well, that's been the progress, is those two voices kind of coming together.
Yeah.
And I think maybe with this book, is they did come together, you know.
You've managed to ride a surprising number of zeitgeists in your... So you were writing about business in New York in the 80s. Good time to be writing about business in New York.
Right.
In the early 90s, you were writing a lot about technology and computers. Groundbreaking time
Internet.
To be writing about that.
Email from Bill.
Did you? Yeah. So you wrote a profile of Bill Gates, largely conducted through emails with Bill Gates.
Right. And I think most people had never heard of email at that point.
Yeah. And it's a profile that has to use up a significant part of the first 1,000 words explaining what email is.
Right.
To put this in time.
Right.
What is it like sort of having written the, did you learn something from riding waves like that and being sort of out in front of stories?
I don't really know if I learned anything from that. I think, you know, I always just try to sort of ask myself what I find interesting, you know, like what I like to do, you know, what like when I'm not necessarily even thinking as a journalist, and then follow that. And I maybe so with With business, it was a little bit of an accident. You know, I wasn't necessarily interested in being a businessman or in conducting business. But with, you know, email, you know, I had gotten interested in it and realized, you know, I mean, this was 1993. I mean, there were people who knew that the internet was going to change the world. I can't say that I was necessarily one of them at that moment, but, you know, clearly this was something that was going to go someplace. Yeah. And the idea that you could email Bill Gates, the idea that you couldn't get an interview, you know, by conventional means, and that you could sit in your room and send an email and get an email back in 15 minutes. You don't have to be a complete genius to realize that that's actually a pretty amazing thing and that, you know, it's worth writing about. So, you know, after that, I did different stuff and I kind of bounced around in terms of, it wasn't like another big zeitgeisty thing that came along.
Did you consciously make the decision to like break off from doing technology stories because you felt like you had sort of had a period of it?
Yeah,
I mean, it's sort of, I guess,
it's hard to do.
Bit like Max Martin and the early, you know, you at a certain point don't want to be the person who's,
you get typecast. Yeah. I think technology's hard to do. I mean, my sort of technique was, you know, to put myself into the story and, you know, experience it as a sort of a newbie,
yeah,
a bit sort of a faux naive kind of narrator. And then the reader would sort of hopefully kind of relate to my experience and then be more inclined to actually think about the technology. And that kind of wears thin, I guess, after a while.
Looking back on your own technology reporting, do you go back and read that Bill Gates profile or any stuff like that? Like, what is it like looking back on it with the benefit of time?
You know, I think that piece starts out with using the phrase the information highway. At that point, we didn't even know whether to call it the internet or the information highway. So there were things like that, or like the beginning of Nobrow actually starts out with music. I'm on the subway listening to Biggie Smalls on my Discman, you know, which was kind of a way of like immediately dating your book. So, you know, there's things that don't really stand up, but I don't know. I look back at it sometimes. There was some good stuff in that Bill Gates article, and it did work kind of as a way of both profiling him and of giving people a sense of what this technology could be used for by using it myself. You know, I think that was a pretty good idea.
My favorite piece of yours is a piece you wrote about stampedes.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I'm not. Is stampede the correct term?
Well, that's a slightly loaded term.
Okay, so I was going to
ask.
Crowd
crushes.
Crowd crushes. Your piece about crowd crushes. And I reread it this morning. And I also read a piece that you wrote, I believe, shortly before it about patent law and the windshield wiper would be.
That was significantly before. That was actually my second piece for the New Yorker.
Second. That's from the early
93.
And both of these pieces, you were unpacking these incredibly complex issues that have elements of psychology, engineering, scientific research, like all of these sort of different things combined, and a lot of history.
Right.
What attracts you to subjects like that?
That's what you just said. I have a piece that's sitting around waiting to come out, which is like that in spades.
Yeah.
It has ancient history. It has little modern physics. It has all this stuff in it. I don't know. I like the challenge of being kind of eclectic, I guess, in a piece, and letting narrative and letting scenes and letting sort of 750-word blocks of text with white spaces before and after, which kind of comes from writing Talk of the Town stories.
Mm.
Writing Talk of the Town stories, which I continue to do, you know, maybe 10 a year, and I've always got some going, is a not insignificant way of understanding my work, I think. I mean, I've written a lot of them. And if you can write like a whole story with like a beginning, a middle, and an end in 750 words, and then you can use that technique, you know, in a longer piece so that each of the sections kind of has that integrity, a sort of narrative integrity, I think it allows you to then really have a lot of ideas kind of bouncing around in there without it seeming overly general or overly complex or just, you know, overly stuffed, because it's always the narrative that is guiding the flow of ideas, and the ideas kind of end when the scene ends, and it has a kind of a feeling of inevitability or kind of a rightness to it. So I like to feel like, you know, things are kind of clacking off of each other in a piece. Like, you know, those five balls that you would hit, you know, like swing one and clack the other one. And I like to like feel like I've set up the mechanism in a way that that can happen. And that it's, once it's set up, it's sort of like a self-perpetuating system, and it just kind of goes off on its own.
You must have written over 100 Talk of the Towns by now, probably. What, like, repeating that that 750 word exercise over and over again, what, I hesitate to say, what have you learned? Because I assume that you've learned and unlearned many things over time. But like, where are you now with the 750 word format?
You know, I feel like I'm sort of getting to my sort of postmodern phase or something, where they're very short. So 750 words is over in a blink of an eye, and if you fight it too much and try to, you know, make it into a longer piece than it is, it doesn't really work. It has to have a kind of, it's a glance, and it's not a glance right on, it's an off-center glance at, you know, at a celebrity or at a, you know, public figure, or, you know, somebody that has been sort of, you know, treated in this way, and you're going to take it this way. And you know, I've also learned that the setup in the talk piece is 60 or 70% of the battle. You want going in to have figured out like a good scene, and a lot of publicists, particularly in the music business, don't really understand this, the need for like a scene, you know, the need not just to have an interview, but to have an interview in a place where the place is going to be part of the story.
When you're setting a scene, how do you avoid that being something that you've sort of engineered?
Yeah, you really need someone, you need two people if you can get them. Because if you have two people, or if you have, you know, a scene going on where there's other stuff and then the person you're writing about, and you can sort of have them connecting in some way, then it doesn't really feel as engineered as if, you know, it's just you and that person in this place. And in talk, you can't use the first person. It's just not done.
You kind of count as zero people in the situation because of the lack of the I possibility.
And you can't, occasionally you can sort of like maybe quote yourself in a quote, but essentially you can't really do that either. So, yeah, I try to, like, if it's a band or something, you know, the last two talk pieces I've done have both been about bands. I haven't actually written them yet, but the reporting of them. And one was this these guys called Darling Side, who were these former a cappella singers from Williams College, who are actually having some success as a kind of a four-man close harmony group. But they're very sort of fresh-faced and youthful and idealistic. And so we went and got milk and cookies at the bakery on West 74th, where you go downstairs, like Levan Bakery or something. And then we walked to Central Park and ate the cookies. And, you know, there was a dog that kept, like, sniffing this guy's crotch, and he kind of tried to push him off. And so the setup with the milk and cookies and going to the bakery and their music being kind of sugary and buttery, like the cookies, you want... You need like the setup. You need like a, a jump, a conceptual jump maybe, yeah, or something that that resonates, that widens it, and then you need some action, and then, you know, you're out.
So did you suggest the milk and cookies?
What I usually do with Talk of the Town is, and I almost always write about musicians now, I usually ask the publicists to talk to the artists and ask them what they like to do in New York. Is there something kind of characteristic? Is, you know, something they wanted to do? You know, you can find the stuff.
When I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking a lot about the relationship of the features to the book. I was not thinking about the relationship of the Talk of the Town pieces to the features. Doing some of these pieces, particularly these multi-strand stories, like the patent story or the stampede story, has an element of doing like five Talk of the Towns, right, and then gluing them all,
yeah,
together.
Totally.
Is like, what is the challenge of that? What is the glue that makes five talk pieces turn into a good feature?
Yeah, it totally feels like that sometimes to me. But the glue has got to be the lead. You have to start. For that to work, you just have to know where to start, and you might not know it going in, but the structure is just everything, because it has to be loose. If you're going to make the scenes kind of work as scenes, and even as little, as you say, like kind of little talk pieces, they have to have enough sort of space around them to breathe. So you really need to begin in a place that it starts the narrative, but it also asks some kind of fairly broad conceptual question. Basically, every morning when I start writing, I read, you know, kind of what I've done, and if I can tell pretty quickly if it's not getting me where I feel like I need to go, and you know, so then it's just like, okay, this part is important in some way, this part that I thought was the beginning, but it's not the beginning, and so I'm just going to sort of move that down, and then. And, you know, the things that are important, the things that need to be in the piece will emerge. And eventually, one of them will be the right beginning. And maybe the thing that you thought was the beginning at the beginning is actually the end. You know, that actually happens more than once. So you just have to do that, I think, and look and be able to, you know, write and then sit back and read what you wrote.
I'm interested in how that process works also in the jump from the feature to the book. Like, you know, looking back on that piece you did on K-pop, you have half a book before you get to K-pop to explain all of the reasons that K-pop happened. When you're doing that in a condensed magazine format, how do you span all of that history?
Well, the K-pop piece, as it appears in the book, is... Well, there's one very significant change in terms of the way it appeared in the magazine, and that's the scene at the Anaheim Center that is the kind of running scene in the book, in the K-pop piece of the book, started the New Yorker piece. So it started outside the Anaheim Arena with the fans in the parking lot, and then you went back into the history of K-pop, but because it was, you know, a 7,000 word piece, it felt like it was better to start and end with the scene and try to kind of contain things within the scene, because, you know, you were going to be going to Korea, you're going to be going back into the history, you're going to be back to, you know, the history of Korean music, you're going to be going into, sort of, you know, plastic surgery and stuff like that. So I felt like I needed a strong narrative wrapper in the New Yorker. In the book, I actually changed it so that it starts with a new section that connects to the notion of hit factories. You know, writing this book has taught me some stuff about books and why books are important.
And why are they important?
Because if books didn't exist, we wouldn't understand anywhere near as deeply our world in general, and specifically how things develop and change. Like, it was a real experience going into a subject that had never really had a book written about it, and seeing that because there was no book, There was no long form treatment of this subject. It was like kind of trying to tell climate change, but only going like one weather report at a time and never connecting them. You couldn't see the patterns. You know, you couldn't see how, you know, this person had changed this way of making music, and then that influenced that person, and that influenced, you know, and because there was no book, no one really sort of knew it. Or if they knew it, they didn't share it. And even, you know, doing pieces about it in New Yorker, I think was hard to, I mean, the first piece, the Stargate piece, definitely like a lot of people related to that piece or were interested in that piece. But, you know, that didn't tell you really, it gave you a sketch of a world in which things had changed, but it didn't really put it into the kind of context that allowed you to really understand why it had changed. And that was what the book allows you to do.
Yeah, and the book goes all the way back to
Dennis Pop,
who, you know, it's all kind of his giant child's,
yeah.
And he's such a sort of a tragic,
yeah.
and probably wouldn't have been someone who you could have pitched a feature about.
No way, because he's dead.
Dead and fairly obscure.
Fairly, no way. Absolutely, no way.
So, coming to the end of this, you have this, I don't know, 3 or 4 feature run in the book. The book kind of marks, I assume, an end to this field of inquiry for you.
I don't know where I could go with it from here. I feel like I've closed the chapter on this particular subject, which is, you know, how producers and top line writers create songs. But I really, in writing the book, I really felt like I kind of found my subject and I sort of found my people in a way I never felt with my previous books. There was a certain point in this book, you know, as I started to go downhill, as you know, as they say, in a good way, you know, where the momentum is behind you, where I actually realized I was having fun, you know, that I was really actually enjoying this. And even though I didn't exactly know every day where I was going, I was really engaged in finding out, and that songs and talking about songs kind of connected back to something that I had loved a long, long, long time ago, you know, as a very early, you know, child. And that was a very powerful thing when I was able to sort of tap into that and unleash that. And I kind of like to read it. I like to get back to that feeling.
Yeah. Is it going to be hard to let go of this topic for that reason?
Yeah, it was hard to finish the book. I mean, I said this. I mean, writing's always hard. It's never like fun, you know. But I did say to my wife, you know, I'm actually kind of sad that this book is finished. I miss it.
Yeah.
You know, and so I look forward to figuring out where I go from here, but I'm not sure.
That was going to be my question. Do you jump right into a totally new topic? Do you take a sabbatical from thematic work and do some one-offs? Like, how do you bounce back?
I do one-offs. That's what I've done. And then that's a good thing about The New Yorker is that you can go and do a totally different subject. I would like it not just to be totally one-off. It would be nice if it were like something that pointed forward to a longer project, but maybe I just have to do some one-offs.
Are you seeing any constellations forming of that kind?
No, I you know, I'm looking forward to promoting this book and to hearing feedback from, particularly from people who are in the business.
Yeah.
Because you know, I mean, ultimately, I think I got it right. You know,
yeah.
I think this is how it works. But he didn't really have a huge amount of contact with people who do this. And I haven't had a huge amount of feedback yet from people who do this, although the people who do it and have gotten back to me seem to sort of, you know, think that I've hit it pretty much right.
This is a loaded question, but do you worry about losing touch? You know, when someone you know, who's been doing this for 23 years, talks about covering chart-topping pop music. Is there like an expiration date where you're like, you know, when I hit this age, no more? You know, McPhee is like writing about like golf ball picker-uppers now.
Well,
like
he's doing his kind of memoir pieces.
And
he's writing brilliant.
And he's writing about being a man who is his age, which is mid-80s.
In his 80s.
Do you feel any of that tension yourself?
The only thing about being older and writing about pop music is actually when you have to like go and interview 25-year-old or 20-year-old pop stars or their handlers. It's not like I personally don't like meeting 20-year-olds. I do, but you do feel like they're sitting there going, man, this guy's older than my dad. You know, and they're, of course, polite about it and stuff, but it's a little embarrassing. I mean, you know, pop music is definitely, like, of all genres, one in which youth is at a, you know, premium. Although in the label side, that's not necessarily the case. And you know, Max Martin is 44. So, you know, the guys that are making the hits are you know, respectable ages. but yeah, you do run into some young people. But that's also true in the tech world too. And you know, it's a condition of being that kind of immersive journalist and following that New Yorker tradition. Your subjects do, I guess, have to grow up a little bit with you.
Yeah.
It feels a little strange to put yourself into a situation where it's a bunch of 23-year-olds and there's no connection to your generation at all. But on the other hand, I don't really feel that you go out of touch. Whether the piece succeeds or fails is not going to depend on whether I'm up to the minute on the, you know, latest sort of social media spot to hang out or you know, the latest, you know, slang words that are thrown around. But it's going to be like the old eternal verities of you know, structural integrity. So much of it is narrative, is figuring out the tricks, and they are tricks, really, that make it go as a narrative. And that's just something that's really the most interesting thing. Because you never ultimately have a formula that goes from piece to piece. It's always going to have to be rediscovered every time you work on a long piece. And you know, that's kind of fun. You know, that makes it fun for me.
Thank you, John Seabrook.
All right, man.
That was excellent.
Awesome.
I recommend everyone check out this book. Normally I say all these stories are available in the show notes, but in this context, I'm going to say, as someone who just read the book this weekend, if you haven't read these stories, I would recommend just reading them straight through in the book. The book puts them in a really interesting context to each other, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Aaron.
We'll be back next week. And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to John Seabrook. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. The editor for this episode was Erica Kramer. Our intern was Molly Bain. Thanks very much to our sponsors, Masterclass, EA Sports FIFA 16, and of course, MailChimp. We'll be back next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.